This episode of the Beauty Industry Podcast was brought to you by Her Lawyer, the law firm for ambitious women in business. Hello and welcome to the Beauty Industry Podcast, your online support community for the professional beauty industry, connecting you with educational pieces, innovative industry products, and inspiration from industry experts. I am your host, founding director of Beauty Industry, Tamara Shaw. Our guest today is Courtney Bowie, founder of Her Lawyer, a virtual law firm for ambitious women in business. Her law firm partners with female entrepreneurs and small business owners across Australia to help them start, protect, and grow successful businesses. Courtney's brand resonated with me most as she understands what women are looking for more than just pages of jargon, hourly rates, or off-the-shelf solutions for their legal advisors. Courtney and I connected through a women's networking Facebook group a couple of years ago and have since reconnected after seeing the demand for your questions in the Beauty Industry Community Facebook group around legality and everything that encompasses that. So I cannot answer those questions myself, and they are best answered from a lawyer's mouth. With all the legal answers for your business questions from Her Lawyer, today we welcome Courtney Bowie.
Thanks, Tamara. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
My absolute pleasure. We are equally as excited to have you. This has been a topic that has been so heavily requested in our Facebook community group. Lots of people asking about legal questions and legalities and everything around it. And obviously, I am not qualified to ask any or answer any of these. So wanted to pick your brains and figure out what the answers are and kind of open that conversation for people who maybe don't have that direct contact to go to. But I want you to start me all the way back from your career path in Her Lawyer. Why have you specifically attracted the female market, and where did you start?
Oh, wow. Okay. So I started Her Lawyer back in 2017, which in some ways feels like not that long ago, but also a long time ago. So I'd been working in law firms for several years, and I was really sick of doing things the way they'd always been done. In law firms, there's a very sort of a set way of doing things that's been around for a very, very long time. And in particular, I really hated the expectation that you were supposed to put in these ridiculous hours in order to be considered good at your job. And it really didn't allow for any kind of a personal life. So in 2017, I decided to start Her Lawyer to start doing things a bit differently and combining those passions. So what we do is we're really friendly and approachable. We do all our work on a fixed fee basis, which is a big thing for clients of law firms. You know, getting that unexpected bill for thousands of dollars is awful. And we're also super flexible. So we do after hours appointments, and, you know, we don't make anyone come into an office or anything like that. So that's all helped us to attract an amazing clientele of women, which is fantastic, because what we are trying to do is to demonstrate to women that it is possible to have a fulfilling career and a really wonderful personal life, and helping women to make that happen for themselves with their own safe and successful business.
Incredible. So lots of flexibility around after hours and having children and the lives that go on around us. And it sounds like you guys are definitely making that more so accessible and available for the female market.
Absolutely. We do calls with mums in the breastfeeding room. We have calls while toddlers are putting holes in the wall. Very flexible and very understanding that, you know, it is a juggle.
Yeah, incredible. So we've had lots and lots of questions come through the Facebook group. We put a poll there and I said, ask all of your questions so that I can ask Courtney. And we've got a few, so I want to ask them to you now. So the first one is, what's the appropriate length of time for a probation period for an employee in the beauty industry?
Oh, that's a good one. So I guess appropriate and legal are two different questions. So if we talk about what the Fair Work Act says, it says that an employer with less than 15 employees can have a probation period up to 12 months, but it's 6 months if you have 15 employees or more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yep. So if we've got less than 15, it can be 12 months. Mm-hmm. If it's more than 15, it can be 6 months.
Yes, and I guess that kind of makes sense. If you have more than 15 employees, you are probably operating quite a large operation, have developed your skills in knowing whether an employee is right for the role or not in a relatively quick period of time. And the reason why we want to stick to that limit is that the Fair Work Act protects employers from unfair dismissal claims by employees on probation. So we want to make sure that our probation period is set within the limits of the Fair Work Act, so that if we do decide that someone isn't a good fit, we're not going to end up getting sued in the end, which nobody wants.
No, absolutely not. And so the second question that came through there, and I guess this kind of ties in with the probation period, is a lot of businesses in the beauty industry are small and they may have under 5 employees. Do we have to have contracts with when you're employing these type of staff in this kind of environment?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. Legally, you're not required to have a written contract, and that's for any industry, except for, you know, very particular ones, but not ones we're talking about today. However, if you don't have a written contract, you will have an implied contract with your staff anyway. And that's what's known as a common law contract. Now, the terms of your common law contract will be based on the award and workplace agreement. But the thing is that the terms of your common law contract are almost certainly going to be less favourable to you, the employer, than if you had written your own contract.
Interesting. Okay. Because I know it can get a little messy, and I know small businesses sometimes they just think, oh, you know, it can be a fine. But definitely having something that's a little bit more solidified is best in both parties' interest, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's not just about having terms that are more favourable to you. It's about setting up your relationship with your staff so that you both know exactly what's expected of the other. And that reduces conflict throughout your relationship. If you both know and can turn to an agreement, which is really simply written, it doesn't have to be, you know, your 50-page agreement or anything like that. It can be really simple, just as long as everyone understands what's expected of them and what will happen in certain scenarios. So, for example, if a staff member isn't meeting their performance requirements, things like phoning in for sick leave, notice of termination, all those types of things just make it so much easier and less stressful for you as a business owner to manage your staff.
And so when creating a contract, one of the biggest things that I guess gets asked the most is the different divisions of the wage bracket for the beauty industry determined on qualification. So how does one know what division they should be paying their staff at?
So to figure out what wage bracket your staff work in, you have to have a look at the award, which is in the available at the Fair Work website, and that sets out the specific rates of pay based on their classification, whether they're working part-time or full-time, and whether or not they're minors. So it's about looking very closely at that award, reading the classification description in the award in a way that is just the ordinary meaning of the words, and then using your best judgment as a business owner to determine what the correct wage is. And my advice would be, if in doubt, get in touch with Fair Work or err on the side of caution and go up a bracket.
Oh, that is good advice. And I guess always making sure that once somebody has qualified, because a lot of the time we can take on a staff and then they may be partially qualified and almost going to be able to complete a few modules and then they'll have their diploma. So once they have their diploma, then reviewing that all over again.
Absolutely. So that having a really good HR practice, and many things in business are about having good back of house systems and making sure that you keep all your records up to date and have regular check-ins with your staff and also on paperwork, things like insurances, but certainly in context of what we're talking about, thinking about the qualifications and making sure that, you know, everyone's wages are up to date with their qualifications and we've got everything that we need to satisfy ourselves that they are meeting those requirements.
Amazing. And so in the beauty industry, most of our business owners start out as a sole trader and then they migrate into hiring employees when they get more of a bricks and mortar store. When should one change their business structure and where do you even begin to do so?
It is a little bit, it seems like a real mountain to get over. It can be very daunting moving into a company structure. It is certainly a lot more responsibility to take on. Once you move into a company, you have certain what's called director's duties, and there's a lot more paperwork and tax and all that type of thing, but it's certainly a consideration that most people should make. So a sole trader is personally liable for all financial aspects of their business, and when you first start out and you haven't got a lot of debts, you're not bringing in a lot of money, it's a pretty low risk business, sole trader is fine. It's when you have things like substantial assets in your own name. So if you own your own home, cars, shares, any other type of property, or if your business starts to sort of incur bigger risks, and one of those would be, say, signing a lease. Signing a lease is taking on a huge liability. They're often for multiple years, and as anyone who has signed a lease or ever tried to get out of one will know, not easy to get out of. They carry a large risk. So it's good if you are sort of touching on either of those thresholds that you consider moving over to a company. The reason being that that's a separate legal entity and it provides a barrier between your personal assets, your home, and your business.
Interesting. Okay. So I guess a little bit more safe in terms of the risk assessment, and then if touch wood, nothing does happen, but then if anything does happen, you've still got some solidity in your home assets.
Absolutely. And there's other considerations for everyone. So if you have really big growth plans for your business, if you might be considering scaling, if you're looking at getting finance either from a banker or an investor, a company structure is often going to be more enticing to them. A sole trader might put them off a little bit. Also tax, once you start making a certain amount of money, it can be beneficial to move into a company structure so that you can pay less tax. But that's certainly something that you should speak to an accountant. But I usually tell people when they ask me this question, speak to your lawyer, speak to your accountant, get them both to give you their honest opinion on where you're at and whether they think it's a good idea to move into a company structure now or maybe 6-12 months time. That might be appropriate for you.
And it's good that you've said lawyer and accountant as well, because sometimes people have very different opinions. So having a soundboard of two different people from two different industries almost is quite good to get their opinions on both either for or against.
Absolutely. In particular, because lawyers can't really advise on tax. So it's important that you get that perspective from your accountant of, am I going to end up paying more or less tax if I do this? It's really important.
And then, so what's the first kind of step you would take in moving from sole trader into a company?
First step is really the registration process, which is not too difficult. It's about, disclosing interests and doing some paperwork, as many things in the law turn out to be about paperwork, and registering that company. But if you have a partner in your business, I would say even more important is to sit down with your partner and work out the terms of your agreement. So if you're moving into a company structure, you'll have what's known as a shareholders agreement, which sets out things like your shares in the business, what each person is expected to contribute, when you'll take money out, what happens if if the whole thing falls over and you want to separate ways, how do you divide the business.
Thank you.
That would be my first step if you've got a partner.
Amazing. And so along with helping small businesses and women specifically do that, another one of the services you provide at Her Lawyer is helping around commercial leasing and property purchasing. This is one of the biggest things that anyone will ever need to do in their industry journey. What are some basic things people need to look for when they're signing a lease or purchasing a property?
So there's a few, and as I said before, it's a massive responsibility taking on a lease. So it's really important that you make sure you know exactly what you're getting yourself in for and that you negotiate the very best terms that you can for yourself, because it's going to be, you know, usually 3+ years. And if you end up with dud terms, that's a long time to wear that.
Mm.
So I guess one of the first and most obvious ones to think about is the total cost involved and whether you can afford it or not. So not just looking at the rent amount, but look at what are the outgoings that you're expected to pay. What is your share and what type of outgoings are you expected to be paying for? Sometimes those are negotiable. So definitely looking at them and thinking about, you know, can I negotiate my way out of this? And if not, is this something I can reasonably afford? And what happens, how much notice will I get if those outgoings change substantially? So that you know that, say, if the water bill is going to go up an incredible amount, that you are going to have enough notice to be able to get the funds to cover that. If it's, you know, no notice, what impact is that potentially going to have on your business?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I guess one of the biggest things for our industry is foot traffic. And I know from experience that real estate can be very charming and say all of the right things and you get X number of foot traffic and people passing by and we've got this type of affluence in the area, and then you open up shop and you sit there and you think, well, where is this foot traffic that was sold to me? Or worse so, you might be in a shopping center and they say, oh, this shop does X amount of turnover, as does the shop next to you. This is fantastic. This is a really heavy trafficked area. You should open your shop there. And then likewise, you know, you're paying 25+ thousand for one rent or, you know, the lease in the shopping center, and then you're stuck there and you are locked into 3- and 5-year leases. And it's so difficult when you're in that position, because that can truly make or break your business. And no matter how good your marketing is or your reach, when somebody cannot find you, it's so difficult to entice them to walk into the business, and then you're almost stuck there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One thing I would caution people looking to sign a lease is that when you are going on something based on a promise from a real estate agent or from the landlord directly in terms of, you know, foot traffic or, you know, whatever it may be that they are telling you that you're basing a decision on, make sure that that is recorded in your agreement, because I would say 9.5 times out of 10, there will be a clause in the contract which says that only this, the agreement is based only on what is in the contract. Anything else, any prior representations are not included. And so then if you tried to pursue anyone for, you know, you lied to me about the foot traffic or the affluence of the area or the demographic or whatnot, it's a buyer beware situation, and it's, you won't have any recourse against the real estate agent or the landlord, which would be really awful.
That's so unfortunate. Can I ask, how difficult is it to break a lease once you've signed it, if you're halfway through the terms, for example?
Very. Very. It's something that is often going to end up causing you a heap of stress, time, money. And it also depends on the circumstances. I mean, if you can prove that your landlord is in breach, then maybe you might have a leg to stand on. But typically, this is the kind of sad thing. Typically, landlords have a lot more money than your tenants, and therefore they have a lot more gunpowder when it comes to fighting someone trying to get out of their lease. So if they don't want you to leave, they can make it very, very difficult for you to try to get out.
Interesting. And I've seen that happen lots, unfortunately.
We will be back with more of the Beauté Industry podcast after this short message from our sponsors. Ladies, do you need a lawyer to help you with the legal side of your business? Her Lawyer is the law firm for you. Her Lawyer offers quick, easy, and friendly legal advice for women in business all over Australia, and they're affordable. Everything you do is a fixed fee, so there are no hidden surprises. Go to www.herlawyer.com.au/beauty to book a free discovery call now. And if you mention this podcast or use the code BEAUTY10, you get 10% off your first project. Hurry, as this offer is only valid until April 10th.
Another question that came through our Facebook community group was, when an employee is creating content, for example, a blog or Instagram page or Facebook or whatever it may be, for the business monthly newsletter or, you know, whatever kind of content we're putting out, whose intellectual property is this? And so for anyone who doesn't know intellectual property means, does that content belong to the employee who has created it or the employer who has commissioned the employee to create it?
That's a really good question. And this is something that comes up quite a bit. So according to copyright law, when a person creates an original work, let's say a blog post, the author of that work gets automatic copyright protection and IP automatically belongs to them. Mm. However, there is an important exception, which is employees and contractors. So if an employee creates IP in the course of their employment or their engagement, if they're a contractor, generally speaking, the IP belongs to the person paying them for it, so the employer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess what I would say is this is another reason why you really do need a written contract with all of your staff, because even though that is technically the law, not very many people know or understand that, and it can end up with, you know, misunderstandings and, you know, fights and that kind of thing. Whereas if you have it written down really clearly in your contract, it's just open book, open and shut.
And so can that employee, if they have created, for example, a blog post and they wanted to use that in the future as a sample of their work, can they do that?
So under the general law, it would be a no. However, you might have in your contract terms, if you do have a written contract, you might say, well, the IP all belongs to the employer. However, you might grant what's called a limited license for the employer to use it as a sample of their work, or you might have what's pretty common is, you know, permission. So it belongs to the employer, no grant of license unless we give you permission to use it.
Interesting. I actually had a little trouble with this many years ago, maybe 10 years ago now. I created a blog post for a company and then I forwarded it to my personal email, and the business owner was checking through the sent mail and she said, why did you forward that to yourself? And I said, oh, well, you know, I just want to use it for future reference and just, you know, to have in my kind of portfolio. And she said, absolutely not. So it's really good to know the kind of terms and technicalities around what is and what isn't correct. And definitely everything comes back to the contract, doesn't it? That's why it's so important.
Absolutely.
Yeah, amazing. I guess there's so many things that are individual to the beauty industry. And I guess due to the nature of our industry and the size of most of the businesses, there isn't always a whole lot of support. And that's on both ends. And that's, I guess, the industry isn't super regulated on so many levels, but there isn't a whole lot of support for the business owner nor the employee when it comes to complaints and resolving conflict. Mm. What is the best way to resolve a dispute in these kind of circumstances?
That's a really good question. I guess without sounding like a broken record, again, they'd probably start how you want to finish and have a contract in place that sets out your dispute resolution method. So in most cases, I would recommend that you include a term in your contract which says, if we end up in a dispute, that we'll end up going to mediation. So mediation is a pre-court step. It's far less formal than court. There's no judge. There's someone called a mediator who is trained in helping two parties who are on opposite sides to see the other person's perspective and point of view and help them to reach a mutually acceptable
resolution of their issues. It's a really good method. It's much quicker, much cheaper, and usually more effective than court. So I'd always recommend that you put that in your contract. However, if you don't have a contract, again, start how you want to finish. Have really good relationships with your staff so that they feel really comfortable speaking to you if something's bothering them. Just as good business practice, have regular check-ins with your staff. If you feel like there is something brewing, you know, pull them aside for a coffee chat, ask them if there's something up, try to get to it while it is small and insignificant, and don't let it keep brewing under the surface and erupt in something, in a massive argument. But I mean, these things do happen. So if it does, I guess the first step would be to try to resolve it on your own. So what some of my advice on this is, always try to be as objective as possible when you are dealing with having a fight with someone. And that can be really hard when you're in the middle of it, because you get, and this happens to me as well, not just because I'm a lawyer doesn't mean I don't have feelings. And you get all fired up and you're really emotional about it. Sometimes it's really hard to be objective. So what I try to do is talk to someone who's not involved, relay the facts to them as much as I can, and tell them only facts, not opinions, not speculation, and get them to give me their opinion. And sometimes that process of relaying the facts themselves to an impartial person can help you to see if you've made a mistake along the way, or can help you to see a perspective that you hadn't. And certainly an impartial person will help you with that.
That's amazing advice. And I love how you're talking about facts there, because we can get very emotional. And often I've kind of been a mediator in businesses, particularly for, you know, business owner versus therapist, or therapist versus therapist. And I've just been an impartial party that has no idea on either sides. And I listen to both sides. And a lot of the time you hear, "I feel," or, "Oh, well, she really hurt my feelings. And I was so upset and I was so angry." And while that all might be true and that's how you're feeling, that's got nothing to do with the facts. So it's drilling down to, well, what happened and how was that said and what was your response? And I really always love to position back to therapists and business owners. If you were to give this situation, if your best friend was in this situation or your colleague was in this situation, what advice would you give them? And they kind of stop and they think, "Oh gosh, that's a really pivotal question. What would I tell somebody else?" Because it is so difficult not to get caught up in how you're feeling, because we put our heart and our soul and everything into this industry. And when, you know, somebody does ill by you, it's really difficult to kind of separate yourself from the fact.
Absolutely.
So going down a little bit further negative, I could say, if something probably hasn't been resolved correctly and then you wanted to exit somebody from the business, what kind of steps do you need to take to make sure that it's a smooth exit, that everything is fair on both parties, and that it's kind of amicable so you can just move on?
Okay, so I'd say there's probably five key steps that you want to follow if you do decide to go down this path of exiting someone. So the first step would be clearly identifying what the problem is. So writing down a list of the key issues that you're facing help clarify your thoughts before you go in to speak to your employee. And again, talking about facts here, not thoughts, feelings, opinions, emotions. Sticking to the facts will be really important. Second step would be to actually meet with the staff member and talk to them about the issues that is happening with their performance or their conduct. If you have a code of conduct or an employee contract, that will usually set out some clear guidelines and you can cross-reference. So that makes it really, really easy to point out to people where their behaviour is otherwise than what's expected of them. And I guess that's another reason why you should have a contract and a code of conduct for your staff. I guess if you're determined to exit someone from the business, this may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but it's a good idea at that meeting with your employee to set up goals and expectations and see if you can give them a chance to meet those before you escalate things to the next level. You do have to give them a reasonable time. And then make sure that you document everything is the third step. So make sure that you document everything that you told them, everything that was said, everything they responded, their thoughts on where their performance was lacking or perhaps if they disagreed. And then the action plan that you have developed to give them some time to improve. Now, typically that would be, say, 1 to 2 weeks to fix an attitude issue or a behavioural issue, or 3 to 4 weeks for a performance issue. But obviously that's flexible depending on the individual circumstances.
What the severity of the nature is.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then the fourth step would be if they're not keeping up, warning letter. And fifth step, you know, if you have used your best endeavours to get them to improve, to fix the issue that's happening, and you've given them an action plan and they're still not fulfilling it, then you are sort of at a final meeting and terminating. Mm. So always make sure that you allow an employee to bring a support person with you, you probably won't need a support person as the employer, but they might need a support person with them. Make sure that you are really thinking carefully about the decision before you do it. Make sure that you think carefully about your wording. I've heard a lot of people say that it's best to treat it like a Band-Aid and rip it off quite quickly and not to draw it out and make it, you know, by waffling on and, you know, trying to make yourself feel better about terminating this person, it's actually not serving them at all. You just want to, you know, tell them, like, this is it, this is what's happening. And let them move on to the next step in their life. And that's probably the best way also to make sure that you are protecting the reputation of your business going forward, because the last thing we want is a really disgruntled employee. We want to make sure that we keep treating them fairly so that there's not going to be any negative repercussions down the track.
And it's a really small industry, and as women, we all talk. You know, there's that saying that if you know you have a good experience, you tell one person. If you have a bad experience, you tell seven.
Exactly.
So definitely, I guess even though it's a really hard decision and hard situation to be in, be as factual, be as polite, and you know, just keep it both neutral and have somebody there for support so that they don't kind of lash out on you if that is the case to be.
Exactly. And if they have someone else there to support them, that helps you from confusing your role, because, you know, as tough as you might think you are, if someone is sitting in front of you and bawling their eyes out, you're going to want to comfort them. And if there's somebody else doing that, you can stay in your professional role and do what needs to be done.
And for the therapist listening, if you are exited from a business, if I could give some advice into just understand that there is always two sides to a story, and sometimes it's difficult to see another person's opinion, but to just take it on the chin if it is in fact fair. And I think just smoothly exit and then just keep that to the side. You know, we don't need moldy peaches in the fruit bowl spreading bad things about business owners. So just trying to keep it all in the bud and just move on, release the energy and go into your next job feeling refreshed and happy and ready for a new venture.
Absolutely. The only thing I would add to that would be if you do feel that you have been treated unfairly, as a therapist and exited unfairly, there's no point, you know, telling other people about it or whatnot, but do seek professional advice. Go and speak to an employment lawyer and get their advice on whether or not they believe that you have a case, and then you can pursue the proper legal avenues if that is the case. We don't want anyone to, you know, be unfairly exited and then not be seeking help. But it certainly doesn't help to go around and speak negatively about a business owner. It's certainly not going to help you.
No, not at all. And I've done many interviews and I have said to the therapist, tell me why you're leaving your current business or why you left your last business. And the can of worms that question opens, my goodness, it is just oh, you could sit there for 15 minutes just listening to the answers. And I guess you kind of just don't, like, as the next employee, you're thinking, oh gosh, if this is what's being said about their last employer, what are they going to say about me? So
exactly,
yeah, it's really
it's not in your interest.
Yeah, exactly right. And so I guess we come full circle here, and this is what I see happening quite regularly. When an employee has exited the business, and a lot of employees say, they're my clients. I treated them. I did the treatments. I got the treatment results, so I should take them with me. And then they might be contacting that client saying, well, now I'm actually working from home, or I'm working at ABC Day Spa. What is correct there?
So this is probably one of the most important reasons to have a written contract in this industry, because your written contract should have a really firm restraint clause in it, saying that after their employment ends, they're prohibited from soliciting clients for a certain period of time away from the salon. So that's usually 6, 12, sometimes even 24 months, usually in a certain area. I guess the reason why I would say, if you're going to try to include this in your contract, get a lawyer to help you, is because these restraint clauses are only ever enforceable if they're reasonable, and a lawyer can help you determine what is reasonable, and that's actually going to protect you when push comes to shove. And then sort of if a former staff member does then start soliciting clients, you can send them a cease and desist and threaten to sue, and that's enforceable.
Yeah, okay. So completely different to a non-compete, but more of a restriction per location or something similar.
Yeah, yeah. The idea is that once they leave your employ, that they should be restrained from sort of taking business away from you after a certain period.
Okay, that's an interesting one. Very interesting. So I've loved all of these questions and answers, and I'm so sure so many of our business owners and therapists have really learnt a lot during today's episode. You are obviously the go-to lady for small business, for women in business, for everything law. Where can our audience find out more about yourself and your services at Her Lawyer?
Great. Well, I guess to find us on the web, we're at herlawyer.com.au. Otherwise, we're on Facebook and Instagram, both at herlawyerau. And if anyone would like to email me directly, I'm at info@herlawyer.com.au.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for featuring on today's podcast. Courtney, we really, really appreciate all of your insight. And I think that's given a lot of people food for thought and how they're going to progress in the future.
You're so welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I hope you loved today's episode with Courtney from Her Lawyer. It's about time that a woman takes her law education and does business with women in a flexible, open, and grounding environment. The conversation was created today with questions from our Facebook member community and our Beauté Industry Pro online member community, which you too can be a part of. Search for Beauté Industry in Google to join us on creating positive industry change. Until next time, stay connected.